from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Today, a new study on nationwide education. So where do we stand?
Michigan students are performing very poorly on national exams, really no matter how you cut the data.
Then, a powerful novel exploring the Chinese-American experience and the search for identity.
They're all characters who struggle with a burden of representation. How do these individual Chinese and Chinese Americans somehow represent or speak for a group? And it's an impossible burden.
And protests outside of Republican congressmen's offices. Folks who don't want an Obamacare repeal.
This is not a matter of theatrics or stunts. This is an effort to try to have civil discourse with our elected officials.
We'll have those stories and much more. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in today for Cynthia Canty. Academics. Just how well are students in Michigan doing compared to kids in other states? We'll get new data later in the hour. And with Enbridge's pipeline under the Straits of Mackinac making the news again, we'll speak with a pipeline expert about just how much we should be worried. But first, across the country, members of Congress have been holding town halls. And some have gotten a little heated.
We are going to repeal the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. It's okay.
Constituents calling out their lawmakers about many issues, including the controversial ACA repeal. Here in Michigan, constituents of Republican Congressman Dave Trott, Mike Bishop, and Tim Walberg are calling on them to hold in-person town halls. Patrick Mayer is one of them. He is a member of Lenawee Indivisible. He is assistant professor of philosophy at Siena Heights University, and he is also a constituent of Congressman Walberg.
I'd like for him to have an open town hall. Open to all his constituents, where we can meet him in person, because so far we haven't been able to get that.
So we reached out to the congressman, and let me just read this. It's a bit of a long statement, but I want to get your views on it. It says, quote, Representative Walberg appreciates the opportunity to hear from all of his constituents on both sides, which is why he held 80 coffee hours and town hall meetings in all seven counties in the district during his last term. Because of the new administration's aggressive 100-day agenda, when Rep. Walberg has been in D.C. for votes and hearings, we have offered groups the option of a video conference to share their concerns with him. We have already held three and are open to more. In addition, Rep. Walberg has already held one town hall and four teletown halls so far this year, and we will continue to do more throughout the year. What's your response to that?
Yeah, he offered us one of those video town halls as well. The problem was only 10 people could attend. No recordings could be made, and there could be no press for it. So we didn't feel like that was a real town hall. What we want is to be able to have him hear our concerns, but also have other constituents of his hear our concerns, and we can hear their concern. As for the events he's already held, he has a troubling habit of not announcing these things ahead of time, and so it's a little hard to get into the events he does hold.
Some of this sounds like maybe it's a little bit of show, too, that I believe that you probably feel very strongly about some of these issues. But it sounds to me like you want the press to be able to be there, that you want there to be this kind of show of folks yelling or at least having their voices concerned. Is that some of what's going on?
Well, our group isn't all that interested in having the kind of town hall where we're yelling. The main reason we're interested in having the press there is so that if Representative Walberg tells us something, there's an objective third party who we can refer to and say, look, remember he told us he would do this thing, and now he's not doing it. Or if he does do it, we can say, you know, great job. Remember when you told us we would do that, now you followed through. So for us, the press isn't so much about recording a show, but recording what he tells us.
Okay, and just final quick question, Patrick. Are you getting any money from any outside groups?
We are not getting any money from anywhere. We currently don't have any money to print things with or even reserve rooms to meet in. So, yeah, we have no budget at all.
Patrick Mayer, member of Lenawee Indivisible, assistant professor of philosophy at Siena Heights University, and a constituent of Congressman Walberg. He is calling on Congressman Walberg to hold some in-person town halls. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now let's turn to a constituent of Mike Bishop. She is Lois Robbins, 87-year-old retiree in Oxford, Michigan, a member of the North Oakland Indivisible team. Lois, hello.
Hello.
What has brought you out to be one of these people now who is calling on your congressman to meet you in person? What's going on for you here?
Well, I've never done this before in my life. I wasn't even sure who my congresspeople were. And this election is just like unlike anything I've ever seen in all my years. And I just realized I could not keep floating around in my apolitical bubble.
What would you like from your congressman, Mike Bishop?
Oh, I and the people in my indivisible team would like to have a face-to-face meeting so that we can express our concerns. So probably a town meeting would be the best thing, but we can't seem to get him to commit to one. The last one I believe that he had was in 2014.
Now, you've been in contact with the congressman's office, with staffers. What have they told you?
Just that nothing is scheduled in terms of a town meeting. And they're very happy to pass our concerns along if we can get in to talk to them. They're only taking us a few at a time. So if we show up in large numbers, there are many who don't get to speak to them. They also recommend that we call in for their tele-town hall, they call it, phone-in thing. I've registered for that, but I haven't gotten to ask a question yet. And most of the calls seem to be not the things that we're concerned about. So, we're just kind of wondering, maybe those calls are screened. We don't know.
What does this tell you about the state of democracy, do you think, in 2017? Is this working?
No. Things that I've never seen before, like lies emanating from the White House, attacks on the media. Yes, we've had those before, but not to this extent. Attacks on science, the cabinet picks, Supreme Court, all of these things are, I think, really very threatening to our democracy.
Lois Robbins, 87-year-old retiree in Oxford, Michigan, says, hasn't been that political before until this latest election. You are also a member of North Oakland County's Indivisible team. Lois, thanks for the couple minutes of your time this afternoon.
You're welcome.
And finally, let's turn now to Julia Gallagher. She is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Michigan, and she volunteers with Michigan People's Campaign, a 501c4 that's part of Michigan United. Julia, you are a constituent of Congressman Dave Trott. How did you spend your morning today?
So this morning, I was one of well over 100 constituents and others who participated in an event outside of Representative Trott's office. And so we gathered with the theme of chicken trot to communicate the fact that our representative has failed his chicken. He's afraid to meet with us. And so our requests are really quite simple, that we would like to be heard, specifically on health care, and we'd like an in-person meeting with our representative. But after repeated efforts, he's not available to us.
And why do you think that is?
I think he's trying to avoid meeting with his constituents. I'm dismayed to learn that our elected officials, in this case in the 11th District, are actually hermetically sealed from any kind of in-person communication with constituents. The only real forum to communicate is through the telephone town halls, which is an extremely controlled medium. And so with now six direct actions at Trott's office to try to appeal for an in-person meeting, whatever format. It doesn't have to be a town hall, but an in-person public meeting to hear real needs from constituents is vital.
Well, Julia, let me read you this statement. It's a little long, but bear with me. We got it from Congressman Trott's office, and this is what the statement says. Representative Trott always welcomes and wants input from all of his constituents. Since being elected, Representative Trott has attended over 1,000 public events.
events, including 40 public forums, town halls, and coffee talks. Representative Trott's office has resolved almost 1,000 constituent casework issues, held over 200 mobile office hours across the district. And in the last few days, Representative Trott has sent over 6,500 written responses to constituents regarding their questions and concerns.
Unfortunately, I can state that the in-person communication, I can't address how many people have received letters, but I certainly can state that since our first effort, with weeks and weeks now of sustained effort to arrange an in-person meeting with our congressman, that has proved to be entirely impossible, and his staff limits any kind of communication, direct communication. Everything's filtered through the staff, and there's no possibility for an in-person communication. We've made repeated efforts through the proper channels, the proper official channels for communication, trying to make appointments, letters, telephone calls. In fact, we've made dozens and dozens of calls to the Washington office to try to schedule an in-person meeting with the staff member that is assigned for that function, and dozens of calls have simply gone to voicemail with not one returned. So to answer the question about accessibility, well, this is the experience of a large number of constituents that are included under Michigan People's Campaign.
And yet some Republicans, some conservatives are saying, look, that this is theatrics, that Democrats saw what happened in 2009 with Tea Party members going to Democratic town halls, and that this is Democrats, liberals, progressives who are unhappy with the agenda doing the same thing. Is this theatrics in your mind?
I mean, I think theatrics and a partisan filter are certainly a framework, but that's not what this is about. This is actually nonpartisan. Michigan People's Campaign is a nonpartisan group. This is not about Republicans and Democrats talking about platforms for health care. This is for real people, real constituents, to communicate their needs, their fears, their concerns with respect to repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act. So this is not a matter of theatrics or stunts. This is an effort to try to have civil discourse with our elected officials.
Julia Gallagher, she was one of many folks who were outside of Congressman Trott's office today protesting what they say is his lack of in-person meetings. They say he has not held a in-person town hall meeting since April 9th, 2015. That is some 680 days.
Just so you're clear, this is private property. I understand there's...
This is our tax dollars.
I understand that. This is their tax dollars, too. This is private property. They don't want you here. Neither did the other offices.
So y'all.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Stories that explore what it means to be Chinese in America over the past century and a half. That's what Peter Ho Davies explores in his second novel, The Fortunes. Ho Davies teaches creative writing at the University of Michigan, and he spoke with Cindy back in December. Three of the stories in his novel are built around real people and real events. The most troubling story is Tell It Slant. It's based on the 1982 murder of Vincent Chin, the young Chinese-American beaten to death in Highland Park by a couple of angry auto workers. They thought he was Japanese. Here's Ho Davies reading from his book, The Fortunes.
He was grappling with Pitts when Evans caught him across the knees as if reaching for a grounder, after which Vincent couldn't have run even if he'd wanted. Then a line drive to the chest, pop, as he went down, two more to the head when he was on all fours, swinging for the fences. I ran back, but too late. Before or after the two off-duty cops working security at the Mickey D's drew on Evans, you might wonder, me too. Vincent's last words, it's not fair, to me, in Chinese, while I cradled his ruined head, blood bubbling from his mouth and nose as he spoke, blood pouring from his ears like oil, his skull felt like rotten fruit. I thought I'd pissed myself, but the warm wetness in my lap was his brains. The blow to the chest broke a jade charm, a little carved elephant that had been his mother's, that Vincent wore on his chain. A bad omen to Chinese, though you hardly needed an omen to foretell what was coming next. The ambulance took him to Henry Ford Hospital, the same hospital he used to take his dad for dialysis, where he lingered for a few days, his mother by his bedside calling him, "Vincent, Mama coming, Vincent, Mama coming," as if from a great distance, before she finally gave consent to turn him off. The same hospital where they told her 30 years earlier that she'd never have a child.
Peter Ho Davies, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Cynthia.
You know, that is a stunning, it's a horrifying passage, and made even more so by the fact that it's true. And you write so authentically, I had to look up and go, wait, was he there? And I realized, no, you were in Coventry, England growing up when this happened. As you researched and thought about Vincent Chin's story and then wrote about it, what did you learn from it?
It's interesting because it's such an iconic story. And even growing up, you know, in Europe, in Britain, in 82 when this was happening, I'd heard of that story. You know, the town I grew up in, Coventry, is a car city, right?
It's
in the Midlands of England, somewhat like the Midwest in the U.S. And I had friends in the car industry, their parents, who were worried about losing their jobs at that time. So some of that economic pressure felt at that time reverberated close to home. And so when I heard Vincent's story, even then as a teenager, it sort of stuck with me, I think. Researching it, though, you know, we move from that space, and I think this is part of the process of the fiction itself, the fictionalized version of the narrative. It's a way of taking this iconic figure, this sort of tragic martyr, but also trying to understand who this person is as a human being. And some of that is in my imagination, but it's an effort to present a kind of, on the one hand, a kind of warts and all portrayal, I think, of Vincent, but also in that process to humanize him. So he's not just this iconic martyr, but a real person whose death means a great deal.
And caused a real ripple effect because, as you point out, in the story, you had the two auto workers, father and stepson, walked away with probation and court costs. In fact, I recall Wayne County Circuit Judge Charles Kaufman, and his quote was, "These weren't the kind of men you send to jail. You don't make the punishment fit the crime. You make the punishment fit the criminal." Between that and the fact that the ACLU and other civil rights groups, they never stepped up. What did that say to you about being Chinese in America?
Well, I think there's a real question there about how we think about race in America,
yeah.
Right? One of the things that people resisted, I think, at the time, even the ACLU, was whether or not we could apply civil rights legislation that had been generated in regard to African-American circumstances, whether we could apply it to other minority groups like Asian-Americans. And it felt as though it was a really interesting moment there, partly for the Asian-American community as well, to think of themselves, do we align ourselves with the majority white community, an aspirational move, or do we align ourselves with other minority groups? And I think that was the choice that was made in that regard.
And it certainly galvanized the Asian community to come together. And I love the way you put it, that lack of action. You know, you had old hatreds and grievances put away. And as you write, two drunk white guys couldn't tell us apart. And we realized we were more alike than we'd thought.
Yeah, one of the really stark ironies, I think, of the circumstances, although it also means a kind of coming together and a bonding of the Asian American community, is there's Lily Chin, Vincent's mother, mm-hmm. who leaves China after the Japanese aggression during the war. She can't stand to stay there any longer because of what she's seen in the war. Mm-hmm. She comes to the U.S. She adopts a child from China. Her child is killed because he looks Japanese. And then she finds herself making common cause with Japanese Americans to protest the attack upon him, which is an attack upon him, but also, of course, upon Japanese Americans.
It's really a stunning story. You also, you begin the book, The Fortunes, Peter Ho Davies, with the story Celestial Railroad about a teenage immigrant named Ling. And it's almost rather Forrest Gump-like in the sense that you've got him in a very key moment of U.S. history, and that's the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. And in that story, you remind us that would have never happened without immigrant labor, would it?
Yeah. I mean, I was really interested in it for years now, going back 20 years to around about the time I first came to the U.S. I took a train journey all across the country, which is really eye-opening for a European. I think it's important for Europeans to get a sense of the continental scale of the United States. You can only do that by feeling it in your bones when you've been sitting in a train seat for 3 days, right? And that's when I first learned about the building of the Transcontinental and the Chinese role. And I was very attracted, I think, partly because I'm half Chinese and half Welsh, to think about the way that railroad is built by Chinese labor coming from the west towards the center of the country and by Irish immigrant labor coming from the east towards the center of the country for those mm-hmm. two to meet. You know, there's a way in which the Celtic and the Chinese are meeting in that space, and that appealed to me, I think, because of my own family background. But it also reminded me that here's a huge civil engineering project, a real nation-building project that binds the country together, east and west, in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, which has threatened to tear the country apart, north and south. And that nation-building is affected by immigrant labor on both sides.
And the other one, that it was heartbreaking, the story in the early years of Hollywood of Anna May Wong, the first Chinese film star. And as you tell her story, and I was checking up on her because I'd certainly been aware of her, she had it. And she was a fashion icon, and she had talent. But talk to us a little about how the Hays Code really kept her career from blossoming.
Right. Well, so one of the things she struggles with is the idea that the portrayal of interracial relations on screen is impossible. It's also illegal in many parts of the U.S. She couldn't herself in her life marry a white person, though she had many white lovers, because of limitations. And, of course, as somebody who's the product of an interracial marriage, somebody who's in an interracial marriage, that predicament seemed very powerful to me in various ways. But I'm also, you know, all of these characters, this is true for Vincent as this iconic sort of tragic figure. This is true for Arling, who's a real historical figure, but a real sort of footnote in history, overlooked really by the history, and Anna May as well. They're all characters who struggle with the burden of representation. How do these individual Chinese and Chinese Americans somehow represent or speak for a group? And it's an impossible burden, right? They're caught up in the ambiguities of that. They all, I think, fall short of it because no one person can speak for a larger group because, of course, what we fall into in that space, even if we represent that group positively, is the danger of stereotype.
You touch on your own background, having grown up in Coventry, Welsh father and a Malaysian Chinese mother. Did you have that experience of being other as you were growing up?
Yeah, I very much felt that where I was growing up. You know, the space that I was in, the city I was in, largely white. And even though I knew one or two other Asian children in school, you know, one of those kids was, you know, his parents were both Chinese, but they were Chinese from Jamaica. So it's a very different background. Another one was half Filipino. So while we were clumped together in various ways, we're also very different, right? And I vividly remember that odd burden of representation, that impossible burden of feeling as a child, particularly as a young child, I'd be waiting at the bus stop, you know, in a line of people, British people, white people, feeling like, well, I need to be the polite guy here. I need to be well-behaved because I want them to have this good impression of, you know, colored people in certain ways.
Boy, that's a lot of pressure on our
young
kids.
It's a ridiculous pressure to
yes.
take on board, right?
Yes.
It's a false burden to take on. And yet,
but understandable.
Yeah, exactly, I think. That feeling of how do I represent everybody else? It's an impossible space to be in, but something that we struggle with. And I think these characters struggle with it as well. To some degree, writing about these characters is a way for me to explore that struggle for myself.
Very much so. And I read you actually did your undergraduate work in physics. That's something else. You came to mind actually last night. I had a really great conversation with a first-generation Vietnamese woman who's a student. She's an undergraduate student. And she said there was such a strong stereotype because she's Asian. She was going into a STEM field. She said it was such a stereotype, and she wanted to write. So she is an English major, and she wants to teach someday writing at the college level. Did you feel those pressures as well?
I felt some of those pressures. Some of them are stereotype pressures. Yeah. Some of them are economic pressures. Right? I was growing up in the 80s. You know, I think some of the same economic pressures that were felt in Britain and the U.S. then are felt in Britain and the U.S. now. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of doing a sort of science degree or a hard science degree, that feels like, oh, there's a job at the end of that, and the way that liberal arts education feels like that doesn't necessarily guarantee
get
those
a paycheck.
Things. Right. Yeah. But I also found that while I was, you know, good to some degree at physics, you know, I was very good at math, very good at exams. I didn't really have a talent for physics in itself, that it wasn't what I loved doing. And that it felt like it would somehow be a burden to spend the rest of my life doing this thing that I might be good at but not talented at, good at but didn't love doing. So it took me some time to figure out that I wanted to change the direction of my life.
And when did you first begin writing?
Oh, you know, I think what derailed my physics career, such as it was that I'd written my first, what I like to think of as serious piece of fiction, just before I went to college. I had aspired before that point to be a science fiction writer. I don't mean to suggest that science fiction isn't serious. I just wasn't very good at it. I was trying to write, you know, space opera in certain ways or write on the page Star Wars or things along these lines. And but in that period of my late teens, my grandmother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. She went into, at that time, a pretty grim home. And that was a very difficult passage for my family. And I began to write about that. And I think in that process discovered some of the resources in fiction emotionally that felt really important to me. There was a new depth to the writing. And I sent that story out to some magazines and got a scribble note back from an editor when I was about 18. And I could barely read his handwriting, but I figured out the one word he'd written back was the word possibilities. Ooh. And the hope of that one word of encouragement, which is about as much encouragement as I got for 3 or 4 years, essentially derailed my entire physics career. Because although I finished that degree, always at the back of my mind was this feeling of, I should try this writing thing.
It was like a seed that got planted and it had to kind of grow. Now, did you have to leave England to be a writer?
I've said that, and I do think there's something to be said for that, right? I felt like I was surrounded by friends and family members who knew me in various contexts, right? Knew me as a son, knew me as a physicist. I knew nobody, probably even at 6 degrees of separation, who aspired to be a writer. In Britain at that time, there was no teaching of creative writing. One of the reasons I love doing it here is because it feels to me that pretty much everybody who goes to college in the U.S. knows somebody or has the opportunity to take a creative writing class. That seems like a very fundamental democratization of art. When I was growing up, you know, who was the most famous young British writer? It was Martin Amis. His father was Kingsley Amis, another great famous British writer. I thought that's how you became a writer. You were born into it, like becoming, if you're Prince Charles, you get to be the king one day, right? So the idea that somebody would teach you and help you to do that was really eye-opening to me. And so moving to the U.S., I got out from under the skepticism of family members and friends. Like, you want to be a writer? That seems like a terribly pretentious thing to do. And my own skepticism as well, and moved into a space where people were not going to look at me and say, you're trying to be a writer, that's crazy, but just, you're trying to be a writer, how could you try to be a better writer? That's the more practical and useful way of thinking about it.
Which you found once you came here.
Yeah.
I'm talking with writer Peter Ho Davies, his new novel, The Fortunes, exploring the Chinese-American experience over the past 150 years. I'm wondering, Peter, as you stand in front of your students now at U of M, are you getting a sense that the students of Asian background, the students of color, are they having a different experience than the characters you draw for us in The Fortunes?
That's a really interesting question. If you'd asked me that question even 2 years ago, I might have said yes and envisaged a more optimistic sense for them and for the future. Today, at our particular historical moment, I have some more questions about that. Right? One of the reasons why the Vincent Chin section reverberates. This is one of the odd things about writing historical fiction. Sometimes you write it because it reflects on the present. Sometimes the present reflects on the historical fiction. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things we think about with Vincent's killing is that it comes out of a space of economic anxiety and the rhetoric associated with that, that comes out of the unions, it came out of the car industry, came out of our local politicians blaming Japanese imports for the decline of the American auto industry in the 1980s. And that rhetoric and that environment and that atmosphere of economic anxiety led to violence in this case and led to a hate crime, essentially. You know, so hopefully I'd like to think that revisiting a story like that, revivifying it through fiction, is a way of reminding us of some of the dangers that we faced then and that I think to some degree we still face now 35 years later.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, as you're saying these things, that I'm wondering what your thoughts were watching the presidential campaign and hearing Donald Trump say, make America great again, and seeing and hearing things said by supporters at Trump rallies. And we know from the Southern Poverty Law Center there's been a 900 reported, more than 900 now reported incidents of hate crimes and actions since the election. Is there a sense of deja vu?
There is. For me, that sense of deja vu comes both from the writing of the book, but also my own lived experience. One of the things I've been talking to my students about a little bit, you know, historical fiction offers us perspective, but hopefully older people, and I now include myself in that category, at least compared to my students, can offer perspective in those regards as well. So again, when I was growing up in the 1980s in Britain, that was a period when the National Front in Britain, a far-right group, was you know, in the ascendance. You know, skinheads were walking the street. I felt a degree of threat. I can vividly remember walking through a busy shopping street in my hometown in the early 80s and seeing a young boy, a teenager, he'd been a little bit older than me, a Sikh in a turban, running through the street being chased by some guys, and thinking to myself, and not even comprehending what I was seeing, thinking, what are these guys doing? And only understanding, of course, when the guys caught him and threw him to the ground and put the boot in, that what this was that was taking place in front of me. That's a dismaying space to be. One of the things that I also remind myself in that moment is that while a lot of the people on that busy shopping street did nothing, I think not because of they were afraid of intervening, but also because they just couldn't comprehend what they were seeing. The person who stepped in was my father. A white man, grew up in a rural space, not college educated, and he stepped into that space and pulled those guys off him and off the kid and sent those guys packing. That's encouraging to me, right? I think back even to the bands I used to listen to in Britain then, bands like The Clash, right, who were tough, punkish, white working class bands, but also at the forefront of the Rock Against Racism movement, right? I always felt as a young person of color in Britain, you know, in spaces that could be a little threatening, I kind of thought, well, I've got Joe Strummer of The Clash. He's got my back. I have the
and
toughest white. I have the toughest white guy on the block on my side. Mm. That's encouraging. I take some hope in this because it feels to me that we are at a moment, I know some of my students feel this, where there can feel like a very sharp division in the country between people of color, between immigrants, and a kind of white working class. In a different historical context, in a different place, white working class people and immigrants and people of color were politically aligned. Right? That's my experience from my time in Britain. So the divisions that we see here do not seem essential. I don't feel as though my anxieties here are about the white working class per se. Maybe my anxieties are about those who would seek to divide us. But I do think there are, in those historical antecedents, you know, both the anxiety and the sadness that we're back in that place, but also notes of hope that we were in that place once and we got out of that place. And although we may be back there again, the cycle can turn yet again.
Well, I got to say, The Fortunes is a beautiful read. I can understand the glowing reviews that are all over the internet for The Fortunes. It's a beautifully drawn book, and these four stories are very, very memorable. Peter Hoe Davies, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Cynthia Canty. And now, please don't shoot the messenger, but we have got some new data on student test scores in Michigan.
Michigan students are performing very poorly on national exams, really no matter how you cut the data. If you look at straight proficiency rates, Michigan is 41st out of 50 states. It turns out that Michigan is the only state in the country where proficiency rates have actually declined over time. It is 50 out of 50.
That is Brian Jacob. He is a professor of education, economics, and education policy at the University of Michigan. He is also a non-resident senior fellow with the Brookings Institution. And Brian, what exactly is the NAEP measuring?
These are exams given to fourth and eighth grade students in reading and math. And they really do try to measure kind of broadly what we think of as kind of the basic skills in kind of elementary and middle school reading and mathematics. There's kind of reading comprehension, vocabulary. There's some work on kind of direct calculations, but also on problem solving and critical analysis in math. I think they're quite similar in kind of overall content as the MSTEP exam that we have in Michigan, but you know they're certainly not identical.
Okay. Now you note in the study that Michigan makes the bottom 10 list on all four measures and ranks dead last in terms of proficiency growth since 2003. What is going on specifically in Michigan here?
Well, that I guess that's the million-dollar question. First of all, there's kind of a funding issue. Michigan doesn't have kind of the lowest per pupil funding in the country, but it, you know, the funding is only at modest levels and has not increased substantially over the past decade compared to some of the other highest performing states where they really have devoted substantially more resources to education. But I certainly don't think it is resources alone. I mean, that is, money might be one factor, but I think it is not the entire story. There may be something about the, you know, somewhat decentralized nature of kind of education in the state that has something to do with it. Historically, Michigan has been kind of a more local control oriented state where districts and localities have a great deal of discretion. And I think for some really high functioning districts, that's great. I think others that have struggled, it's not so good.
But I want to dig into this idea, because one of the things that this study looked at, as you mentioned, is kind of this giving control back to states rather than the federal government sort of setting standards. So this is an issue then that you're saying could be part of this.
Right. I mean, I think the motivation behind the report was over the last few years, even before the new administration came in, the federal government has been moving to relinquish some of its control over education policy. In 2015, Congress passed the Every Student Succeeds Act with strong bipartisan support. And what this did is really get rid of kind of an older No Child Left Behind system of kind of more strict federal school accountability and gave the states a lot of discretion and flexibility to kind of work on their lowest performing schools in whatever way they saw best. And now the Trump administration, I think, is clearly focused on giving more power back to states and localities. And so what I wanted to do is kind of look across the states and see how performance was across all 50 states, how different states were doing over time.
So, Brian, when we look at this data, it is hard for me not to bring up right now, just because of the news, because of the country's new education secretary, Betsy DeVos, to bring up charters and the role that they could or are playing in test results. Help me understand where charters come into all of this.
That's a great question. So I think charters can have a very positive role to play in the education system nationwide and in Michigan. I think there's a number of charter schools in the state that the data suggests are doing very, very well. I think the key to making kind of charters work overall for the whole state is that there needs to be some more regulation and oversight than perhaps what we have now. I would never suggest that we should burden charters too much, but Michigan is kind of notorious for having the loosest and most open system. We've all heard the reports about the situation in Detroit, where there are so many charter schools that there's lots of empty seats in the charters and in the publics, and parents don't have great information, and charter schools that are not doing particularly well are allowed to continue year after year. Again, a little regulation is not a bad thing, and that could be used to make the charter sector really work well for the state.
So talk to me a little bit about the NAEP. This is, again, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, because there's been some pushback against this report from folks in the state who say, look, we don't use those tests that we here are aligned with the M-STEP. So can you explain a little bit about how this measurement is actually working?
I mean, to be honest, I think that's not a very good argument, or certainly not an excuse. I mean, the M-STEP and the NAEP are both kind of standardized assessments that have some multiple choice but some open response. The M-STEP has a slightly different focus that is tailored to Michigan's curriculum, but the correlation between NAEP scores and M-STEP scores is extraordinarily high, and they're both kind of tapping the same fundamental academic performance measures. One point that is worth taking away is, as districts across the state do try to reform, I think it would make much more sense for them to kind of use the M-STEP as a good benchmark and target, as well as any other diagnostic assessments the district gives, because the NAEP is only once every 2 years. It gives kind of a statewide perspective, but it doesn't have separate results for each district and certainly not for each school. So I think, state educators and policymakers should be focusing on the M-STEP as their benchmark, their scale. But I'm confident if there's, substantial progress on the M-STEP, there will be substantial progress on the NAEP.
Now, so there are not necessarily reasons or specific reasons that you're going to come out and say, here is why, Michigan is not doing well or Michigan students' results are below average. But let's look at the states that are doing well. Are there specifics in those states that we could look at and go, well, Michigan isn't doing those, so maybe that's what we need to borrow from?
Right. Massachusetts, stands out in many, many ways as not only a very kind of high-performing state, but one that has experienced considerable growth over the past decade. I think they have done a really good job in having a kind of careful accountability system that has as much support and development for schools as it does kind of punitive measures. You know, Massachusetts has been quite successful, based on some recent evaluations, in reforming low-performing, even quite high-poverty schools and districts. There was Lawrence, Massachusetts, you know, was a poor urban district that was, you know, in really bad shape a decade ago, and the state kind of helped lead a turnaround effort there that was quite successful. I think that could be a good model for some places in Michigan.
Brian Jacob is a professor of education, economics, and education policy at the University of Michigan. He is also a non-resident senior fellow with the Brookings Institution. We have been talking about his new report on some new data on student test scores nationwide and specifically here in Michigan. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Zoe Clark, and today for Cynthia Canty. The oil pipeline that runs beneath the Straits of Mackinac is making headlines yet again, this time because the pipeline's structural integrity has been questioned. So what does an expert with four decades of pipeline experience think? Cindy spoke with Richard Cooperwitz of AccuFacts Incorporated.
It was April of 2010 when Enbridge Oil Pipeline 6B ruptured, spilling more than 1 million gallons of Canadian heavy crude oil into a creek near Kalamazoo. It became the largest inland oil spill in U.S. history. And that made Michiganders acutely aware of the network of oil pipelines that run across the state and under its waterways, particularly Enbridge Line 5, which runs in the Straits of Mackinac. And then there's the recent news about two idled pipelines in the St. Clair River. They're 98 years old. There are people who fear another pipeline leak, and there are others who think the science is not being represented properly and the fears are overblown. What do we really know about these pipelines, about how they're made and used and maintained? Well, let's turn now to Richard Cooperwitz, who's president of AccuFacts Incorporated. Good to have you on Stateside, Richard.
Good day.
Tell us about your background and what capacity do you work in the pipeline industry?
I'm usually brought in to investigate incidences lately in the last 10 or 15 years. I've got over 40 years' experience in various aspects of the energy industry, the majority of it with pipelines. I've represented both pipeline companies, the public, local governments. They usually bring me in to try to be a neutral party, make sure they're asking the right questions, and more importantly, the answers to those questions are being answered truthfully and factually.
So here in Michigan, certainly, as I mentioned, there's much attention focused on Line 5 in the Straits of Mackinac and the fact that they're over 60 years old. Does that figure, does that age concern you?
No, it doesn't. And I'm probably closer to those lines than the average person. I was actually out there with scuba divers checking the condition of the line, and they weren't for Enbridge personnel. They were for other parties. But the age of pipelines and transmission service like these are isn't really a leveraging factor, because even steel of over 100 years ago, pipe steel does not wear out. It isn't like an automobile engine. The real factor on pipe steel, this is a very important distinction, is what we call the vintage. Depending on how the pipe was made and, you know, what its specifications were and the various processes used to make the pipe, there can be various different types of threats depending on the vintage of the pipe.
So it's the vintage and not the age.
That's correct. And the vintage we usually use to screen for certain different types of threats that can be attributed to the vintage of certain pipe steels that could result in pipeline failure. Ironically, even new pipe steel, if it isn't respected appropriately, can actually fail quicker than some of the pipelines that are 100 years old. So it's just an ironic situation.
Interesting. So what's the main cause of pipeline failure?
Depending on which database you go look at, you'll get a lot of different stories. In some cases, I think people are trying to be honest in their answer. In other cases, they're trying to spin another agenda. But we tend to see in liquid transmission pipelines, like the Line 5, corrosion tends to be still leading, if not the major cause of pipeline failure. There are some people who will say third-party damage is the leading cause of pipeline failure, but for liquid transmission pipelines in the United States, we don't think that's an accurate statement.
How has the science of corrosion in pipeline steel, how has that changed or evolved in the decades that you've been in the business, Richard?
It's especially in the 60s, the technologies to protect against external corrosion as well as internal corrosion took quantum leaps in our scientific understanding. In parallel with that, since I'll say roughly the 70s, the tools to use for inline inspection of transmission pipelines and if they can use these devices, and these are multi-ton devices that are inserted and flow inside a operating pipeline, specially designed for a particular type of threat, especially in the area of corrosion, have advanced considerably since, I'd say, the mid-70s. And in the last 10 or 20 years, the accuracy and reliability of corrosion inspection tools have advanced considerably. However, despite that, corrosion still tends to be the leading cause of transmission pipeline failures.
Hmm.
You can have a good tool, but use it unwisely.
What can you tell us about what happened with the Kalamazoo River pipeline with that rupture? Were they able to identify what kind of corrosion that was?
Yes, it was two specific types of corrosion. There was a fairly serious general, what we call general corrosion wall loss. In other words, external corrosion caused the pipe wall to thin. And then on top of that, they had a very specialized type of corrosion called stress corrosion cracking, which is an environmentally type form of corrosion, a specialized form of corrosion that on top of the general wall thickening caused cracks to occur in the pipe that penetrated the existing remaining pipe wall. And so it got to a certain thickness of pipe steel from these two types of corrosion, and it went to failure at a very low operating pressure.
When you investigate a pipeline break, let's move away from the Kalamazoo River one and just talk in general. What are you looking at, Richard Cooperwitz, when you go in to investigate the material?
We follow a general process step that has various baskets that we look at. And the first thing we'll tend to zero in on is if it has a remote controlled system, a SCADA, what we call a SCADA, where they remotely monitor their pipeline, we'll look at that operation as one basket of interest. And then we'll look at things like the pipe material, you know, how it's operating, what's the environment, where is it located. And then we'll investigate various management processes to see if the pipeline company is actually understanding, you know, what their responsibilities are. And more importantly, are they exceeding certain minimum standards like the federal regulations?
What's more important in your view, the material or the company's maintenance of that pipeline?
Both. I can't give you an answer to saying that they're of equal value. It depends. They'll swing from one to the other. You can have the best steel in the world, and if you don't respect it in the wrong environment, it's not going to last very long.
That word you used really jumps out at me about respecting that material.
That's right, because you know these are pipelines that by their very nature are moving hazardous liquid. You know, they're sure can be damage to the environment, but there also can be very serious threats to personal safety and the public safety. And so I don't fear this material.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of pipeline companies, and I won't name them because I don't want to jinx them, but there are pipeline companies who understand their roles and responsibilities and stay well ahead of minimum federal regulations on pipeline safety in operating their pipelines.
So looking back at what happened with Line 6B and looking at all the reports, what went wrong there?
Well, I've never seen a single event failure in my 40-plus years of investigation. It's a whole series of failures. And if you were to look and read in detail the public NTSB report, you're going to find that there were failures on many levels, on many fronts, in many areas of that operation.
Hmm.
Again, I'm not here to belittle or badger the operator who is Enbridge Pipeline, but when you read the report, it's just downright embarrassing.
Hmm.
And that's not a place I want a pipeline company to be at.
For the public, how do we as the public know whether a company is doing what you know they should be doing, respecting the material, maintaining those pipelines, and that it's telling us the truth about that? How does the public know?
That's a fair question. First of all, it's not that technically challenging. This isn't rocket science. Right? So an operator with a good story respects that they cannot disclose everything about their pipeline. But what they do disclose ought to be factual, truthful, and consistent. And so if they're caught in too much PR spin, it's hard to maintain their stories. And so you'll see inconsistencies in some of the way they deal with problems. If the public sees that, and I've been in investigations where they clearly recognize that, the operator loses considerable credibility. And so that's the thing I constantly warn operators about. We understand you can't disclose everything to the public, but what you tell them, if you've got a good story, you should be able to tell them the truth. You know, trying to prevent the public from knowing certain type of information that's very important to gaining the respect of the operator under national security claims are way overblown.
Giving us the engineer's take on these pipelines, Richard Cooperwitz, president of AccuFacts Incorporated. Richard, thank you so much for spending time with us and talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
And that is Stateside for today. I am Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cindy Canty. She will be back tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening.